Simon loved to draw. He would have liked to draw all the time, and occasionally he would even draw on the fence on the way to school. But he never finished anything he did. He was lazy. One morning, on his way to school, he had a surprise. He found a strange figure waiting for him by the fence. Simon recognized it at once.
Hello, you're the old soothsayer, aren't you?
Yes, I am, and you're late, me old son. They're almost ready to start recording the next podcast. Here, I've got a shortcut we can take. Get yourself up this ladder and over this fence sharpish.
Okay, anything for a giggle.
Go on, up you go, me old China bun.
I'm going.
Squacks deck diddly, and welcome to the Diddly Dumb podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to part two of our comic strips special. If we just carried on last time, we'd have been there for hours and hours. So here's part two. What's been happening? We've got all the doors sealed because there's a real Barney going out in Biscuit Factory Square. The Dennis the Menace fan club are out there squaring up against the Ovaltinis. It's like Quadrophenia out there.
What, you mean we've got a beach outside the Hooseum? How have I never seen this?
Got an alleyway.
I've been up that alleyway.
Yeah, I bet you have.
And to sound less romantic, I took my wife up that alleyway as well.
Well, and we're not broadcasting that.
What a honeymoon that was.
Oh, I just realised how that sounded. I'm sorry.
I was there way before you were.
Oh, Simon! I hope you're referring to getting the Dupont Chandra.
Oh, dear.
Oh, Christ.
Oh, that's got to stay in.
I can't broadcast that.
Oh, I really think we should.
Right, where were we?
Can I just tell you about a little purchase I made a couple of days ago in between parts one and two?
If it's jammy, no, you can't, but go on. Of course you can. Liberty Hall.
Let me just put those nine cans of the Daleks Master Plan back under my bed. I was going through doing the Doctor Who rewatch at the moment, and I'm up to Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Yes.
And I thought, God, it'd be really nice. I really want to watch the Peace Cushing films again. And I went to the Doctor Who collection I had, and I thought, oh, my Dalek collection's not there. You know, the two films from the 60s. Mm. That's odd. I swear I had it on DVD. Anyway, basically saw them that on eBay someone was selling both films for a fiver each. So I snapped them up for a tenner, and they arrive tomorrow on Blu-ray.
Oh!
So, yes.
Damn it!
They look gorgeous, just so you know. They
do look gorgeous. Looking forward to it. I'm looking
very jealous.
So last time I spoke about the Fourth Doctor comic strips from DWM. Mm-hmm. Then we followed that on with Rassilon's Horn Sounded, and Simon spoke to us about some of his influences: Jamie Hewlett, Alan Martin, Tank Girl. I thought I'd best not go into that. Jamie Hernandez, etc., etc., etc. Mark then spoke to us about the Fifth Doctor strips: Tides of Time, Starship on Stockbridge, Stockbridge Horror. Dave Gibbons hanging over to Mick Austin. Mark informed us that Gus is a female Tegan. Simon told us about his his youth visiting King's Reach Tower and the Peter Davison Easter egg, which I didn't really get. And that was the point at which we stopped. So, do I hear the horn of Rassilon sounding there? Fire away, Hayden. What's your subject?
I know what I'll go with, because it's something which I've only read actually as an adult, which may shock, surprise, and maybe titillate some of you out there. I've only read Marvel as an adult, would you, Adam and Eve? And I'm obviously not counting DWM here, because that always felt like it was a sort of a very separate universe anyway. But yeah, I think I talked last episode about the Rites of Passage, and I think one of the comics that you read when you are getting older and you're looking for more sort of adult material is Watchmen. And I went from Watchmen and then sort of graduated onto Marvel from there. And of course, this is certainly something I've really read as an adult. I think probably my mid-20s onwards. And of course, the one I started with had to be the Infinity Gauntlet, which I have to say, I probably had it 3 or 4 years, I reckon. And I must have read it 5 or 6 times. I think it's a staggeringly good story in an incredibly long saga, but I know it works in a sort of like 30 graphic novel series, doesn't it? The Infinity Saga. But as a standalone story as well, I think it works incredibly well. And I think there's enough in there, obviously. I mean, a lot of people will have obviously seen the film and never read the comic, but I think the artwork's fantastic. I think the story's brilliant. I think there's just so much more scope that you can do with the artwork in these comic books than you can on TV. Even with billions of pounds of CGI to be thrown at it, I think it's much more visually striking as a book. Yeah, and I absolutely love it. And then from there on, I started seeking things out like Secret Wars, The Death of the Stacys, The Amazing Spider-Man, The Coming of Galactus, Fantastic Four, The Deadpool, the first 6 Deadpool graphic novels, so Dead Presidents, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly are probably the best out of those. And another one that I really came to love was Daredevil. The Man Without Fear is probably the best origin story I've ever read. And of course, Born Again, which was, I think, probably has grounds for being, I don't know. It might actually be my favourite Marvel graphic novel, I have to say.
I can concur that it is absolutely brilliant.
Ah.
And the artwork is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful, yeah.
Who did the artwork again? Somebody whose name I can't pronounce, I think.
Hang on. It's in the other room. I'll just Google. It's obviously Frank Miller, isn't it, who wrote it?
Klaus Janson, is that his name? That's who he was doing the Frank Miller stuff.
No, it's, is it Matthew Kelly? Is it Matthew Kelly?
Tonight, singing live.
Oh, David Mazzucchelli.
Mazzucchelli.
Yes, that's it. It wasn't Matthew Kelly at all.
David Matthew Kelly. Brilliant. Yeah. That's a good way of remembering it.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible redemption story, as it were, for Daredevil superhero. Well, it's more of a character piece of
Matt Murdock.
I wanted to say Peter Parker. What an amateur. Yeah, it's a real redemption story for Matt Murdock, and really gives a glimpse into sort of how his behaviour and his double life as well really messes up his friends around him.
Mm.
As well, it's really dark, and it is. It's definitely one of the things I couldn't have read as a child. Absolutely not. But I think when you come to these things as an adult, it's quintessential Marvel. It's Marvel in the '80s where it started getting a bit darker, a bit more adult, a bit more introspective as well. It's an 11 out of 10 for me.
Mm.
The funny thing about Marvel and darkness, though, which is always why Marvel has always struck me as having that bit more meat on the bones, is that the darkness comes from the characters rather than it being hoisted on them.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yes.
I know that Batman is kind of dark in its idea, you know, and it was originally quite dark, but of all the DC characters, he's probably the only one of some of those early ones. But, you know, it was there from the off, wasn't it, with Daredevil? I mean, where, you know, he was in Devil's Kitchen and he had the Kingpin, so, you know, the underbelly of crime and that sort of thing. And then with Spider-Man, there was the fact that from the off, he was an anti-hero, wasn't he? He wasn't liked by anyone and he had all problems and things like that. And that was always the great thing about Marvel Comics, is the characters had grit from the off. They had reasons for being who they were.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, he was very domesticated, I think, Spider-Man too.
Yeah.
He had quite a domesticated approach. I think the darkest, and probably, again, they are, there's so many volumes, actually, which are up there. But the X-Men comics as well are incredibly dark.
Mm.
God Loves, Man Kills has Professor X crucified in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really brief story, but it's visually incredible, actually quite disturbing in places. And again, one of those that you think, especially as a child of the 90s, oh, the colourful cartoon with the really addictive theme tune. You know, oh, I'm going to read this and, oh my God, what has happened to Patrick Stewart? You know, it's all, it's a bit of a mind... Yeah, it's...
Yes, when they were relaunched, when they relaunched the X-Men, that was brilliant, wasn't it? It was Chris Claremont?
Yes.
When they relaunched them with Wolverine and Colossus.
And Nightcrawler was there. He wasn't there from the start, was he? It was around about the time that...
Oh, yeah, I think he was, wasn't he?
Was Nightcrawler an original X? Oh, yes, he is, because he's in Marvels, isn't he?
Sorry, no, he was in the new X-Men, as in Wolverine onwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was Wolverine,
Storm.
Storm, Colossus, Thunderbird, who got
Argo
killed off fairly quickly, didn't he? I think. In the comics.
Thunderbird. Oh my God, I've forgotten about him.
he died very quickly. Because I remember seeing the promotional shots for the new X-Men, and there was a grave from the off. So I never actually got to see him until much later. But it's quite exciting, wasn't it? It was for me at the time. It was like, who are all these people? Because Nightcrawler ended up being my favourite ever Marvel character. I still adore him, particularly the way that Alan Davis and Chris Claremont portrayed him in Excalibur.
Mm.
He kind of got rid of the shackles of his hang-up with his religion and all that stuff and started being a proper swashbuckler, which is what he was always born to be, really. So, I love Nightcrawler.
If you're looking for two very good back-to-back graphic novels of high quality, you could look no further than the Dark Phoenix saga and Days of Future Past, which run into one another. And you just think that's some high-quality sequencing of storytelling. And even to the point that with each issue of the Dark Phoenix, there's one front cover where you've got Jean Grey sort of crushing the X-Men font. And then progressively, the titles after that, the font is slowly recovering, but it's still cracked. If you look at all of the issues going forward.
I'll have to check that out.
Until I think it's Days of Future Past, where there's still cracks in it, even up till then. So it's really cool. I love that. Attention to detail is fantastic.
I do have on my iPad an app, which I don't know if I've mentioned it before now. It's called Marvel Unlimited.
Okay.
It's basically like Netflix but for Marvel comics. You pay a certain amount each month. I can't remember.
$10 a month.
$10 a month. Yeah, so it's a tenner or a little bit less than the tenner, I think. And you get access to pretty much every, apart from the last 3 months, but then there's not been a lot published in the last 3 months, has there? So
No.
You get all of the Marvel back catalogue pretty much, or 90% of it.
Crikey. Oh, you've beaten me to it, because one of the things I did during lockdown was sign up for that. I got the free, you get 7 days free, don't you? And then I did another month, and I just crammed and crammed because I had time. I stopped because I don't have time to read all the stuff. But it was amazing. And I was going to say to you, Hayden, is I've only just read the original Infinity Gauntlet on Marvel Unlimited, only about a month or so ago. And George Perez, I adore his artwork.
Oh,
yeah,
he's awesome. Brilliant.
I grew up with the one of my main comics when I was a kid was the New Teen Titans.
Oh, nice.
Written by Marv Wolfman and drawn by George Perez. I absolutely adored those. Those were definitely my number one, them and Batman, my two favourites.
This is where I show my age, because I grew up with him drawing the Avengers in the early 80s, I think it was. But I was going to say, if I'd known you were going to mention it, Hayden, I would have flicked some pages at the microphone, because I've got my original copy of Days of Future Past, the first issue, which I got, I think it was 15p from my corner newsagent.
No.
When it came out, so I've still got my copy of that, yeah.
We're up to our ears in gloaters here. Can I come in for a gloat? Oh, you heartless gloaters!
I have to say, that wasn't wonderful when you could go into your local newsagent and they'd have that massive rack full of American comics.
Yeah.
Imported.
You see, I never used to remember this. I'm sure they were there, because if they were where you were living, Mark, and probably Simon, have you always been in the West Country?
No, I grew up, I was born in Kent,
That's right. Well, then there must have been... They must have had them in the middle of Manchester.
I was in Kent, but I used to come down to Cornwall on holiday because my uncle and aunt moved down to run a campsite. And on the in the campsite shop, there was one of those spinning racks, and it had Marvel comics on it. So every now and again, I'd be allowed to come up and pick a comic. And that's the irony, is I bought them in Cornwall. But then I realised that W.H. Smith's back in Orpington was selling them. So I've got happy memories of going in there and persuading one of my aunts to buy me the second issue. There was a Marvel team-up edition of Spider-Man teaming up with Yellow Jacket and the Wasp. And the artwork was by John Byrne, and I think it was inked by Terry Austin. It was just stunning artwork. And it absolutely set me on the path to wanting to be a comic artist. I just thought, if I can create images like that, just amazing. But I do remember the first comic I had was a Marvel comic, an American one, and it cost 8p. I know. And it was Marvel Super Villain Team-Up. And it was a team-up between the Submariner and Doctor Doom.
Oh.
And I just remember it being really odd, because obviously the Submariner was painted, and the Fantastic Four were in it as well. But the Submariner was painted as a villain, which was kind of, you know, early age, you get that weird nuanced idea that these characters can be one way or the other, because the Submariner doesn't pick a side as such, does he? He's separate to the lot. And that was, I think that was Herb Trimp artwork as well. And it was nicely inked as well, because I'm not a massive fan of Herb Trimp, but it was really nicely inked. And it's that, we'll come back to it later, because there's a massive difference between the same artist being inked by two different people, isn't there? It really is. We'll come on to that with John Ridgway, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think Mark... Has Mark gone yet about his comics?
I haven't done my bit, no.
Okay, are you going to mention Batman at all? Because I'll save this for then, if that's...
No, not necessarily, no. Probably more likely to talk about kids' comics and my appearance in Spike comic.
All right, okay then. Yeah, I mean, the other thing, I mean, I always had more DC. I've had DC comics since I was probably in my mid to late teens, I reckon. And the thing I noticed with that was that, even though you say, Simon, that Batman was a bit dark from the start, I've read the first few issues of Bob Kane's Batman, so the real proper old stuff, and there still is that campiness there, which obviously came through the comics and obviously the TV series in the 60s. But with Year One, that all completely changed. And I remember having a friend who moved to Australia years and years ago. But before he went, he used to recommend me some DC books. And read stuff like Year One, The Cult, The Long Halloween, which I think is brilliant. I'm due a reread of that, actually. It's been far too long. But the one that stuck out is one that I read recently, a Batman one, where it's still, the art sort of had that colourful campiness of the Adam West era Batman, but the story was becoming far more darker, and I wondered if this was sort of a bridge between what we became accustomed to with Year One and The Dark Knight, and how the way that obviously the films then changed the culture around Batman. You know, it was no longer, you know, pants on the outside of your trousers. It was now dark, mysterious, dangerous, and violent. And I think that sort of transition story for me is Death in the Family. And, I mean, like I said, I only read it in the summer, but it's obviously Jason Todd trying to find his real mother, tracks her down to the Middle East, where she...
Jason Todd being the replacement for Dick Grayson, who was Robin.
Yeah, the replacement for Nightwing, basically.
Yeah, he took over as Robin, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was a young guy who the Batman found him trying to steal the wheels off the Batmobile, didn't he?
That's it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, he tracks his mother down to the Middle East and decides to go alone, and Bruce Wayne travels out there as well, because the Joker's stolen a nuclear missile, hasn't he? And they do discover Jason's mother, but she's embroiled with the Joker, and basically the Joker murders Jason and his mother, and it's a real turning point for Batman, well, for Bruce Wayne, sorry, and Batman in general, about, you know, having these youngsters basically being his accomplice. And I found it really good, actually. I'm surprised I hadn't read it before. I just queried about the arc being called A Death in the Family and the front cover showing a dead Robin in the hands of Batman. Maybe it's a bit of a spoiler. It's sort of the opposite Earth Shock, I think, really.
Yeah, they actually ran a poll, didn't they? A telephone poll before the last issue to see whether or not people wanted Robin to live or to die.
Yes.
And it was a telephone poll, and they actually voted for him to die.
Yeah.
Which is like,
Imagine if Doctor Who did that. Blimey.
Well, oh God, don't let the fans take control, for God's sake.
So yeah, that's another one of those I've read recently too, which I just wanted to fit in there before we got on with the Sixth Doctor stuff.
Hmm. It's interesting in as much as reading through the stuff when I did the Marvel Unlimited, I read the more recent Secret Wars, the 2015 one.
Okay.
Because obviously there was an old one in, was it 85, something like that, where it was, yeah. it was essentially where all the heroes and all the villains got plonked on a battle world planet to fight each other. But the new one is, oh, who's it written by? But I've read a few of his comics and they're always really brave stuff. Jonathan Hickman, that's it. Mm. It's something else. It's kind of what DC, you know, obviously DC have done these reboots a number of times now, haven't they? Where they start creating these parallel worlds and different versions of Earth where they have different versions of the same characters. So you end up buying comics that bear no relation to each other. There's no, you know, the chronology is completely to pot. So they've kind of rebooted a few times where they have these massive stories like Crisis on Infinite Earths and things like that, which there's a TV version now, isn't there? Is there a TV series right now of it? Or?
Yes, there will, yeah, the crossover between The Flash and Arrow.
And where they're bringing in all the different versions of from different films and TV series all into the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Secret Wars one they do is essentially where there is something is going to happen to the multiverse, which is going to destroy everything. And that happens, but Doctor Doom and Doctor Strange team up and together they manage to save elements of reality and bring them all back together into one world. Right? I mean, while different versions of Reed Richards from two different Earths have created these bubble ships that have protected them from what's happening, so they land, so then you end up getting like two versions of certain characters. And it's beautifully written. The artwork is incredible. But it did make me wonder about, you know, with all the hoo-ha we've had with the most recent climax with the Doctor Who series, where fandom basically throws its penny up and says, oh my God, you've changed everything and all this sort of thing. Really, Marvel Comics fans should be used to all that. And certainly DC Comics fans should be used to all that. Yeah. In as much as these characters just get thrown up in the air and they see how they land. And I think it's fascinating. I mean, since I've been doing writing, I don't know if you agree, Hayden, is that you... It's like if, for instance, somebody says, oh, do you fancy writing a bit of fanfic of Doctor Who? And it's got to be based upon a particular story, or say you've got to elaborate on a story that already exists. Yeah. The one you want to be given is the one that's really, either really rubbish by reputation or has some bits in it where you can be a bit cheeky and do some weird stuff. I mean, it's kind of the temptation of fanfic is to kind of do that and throw characters together who shouldn't be together and things like that. But, you know, the whole reason Chris Chibnall did what he did was because it was a story he'd written when he was it 14 or 16 or something like that, that he'd always wanted to do?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was around about the time when he was berating Pip and Jane Baker live on TV, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the temptation is there to do all this stuff. And I think sometimes you've just got to let the artist or the writer be to do what they want, because these things are big enough to kind of recover. If they want to bring characters back, they can. If they want to change things back, they can. And I think almost like reading Marvel Comics and DC Comics, because these things are so elastic and they can kill people and bring them back and all that sort of thing, it kind of trains you up for this sort of thing. And I suppose the same with Star Wars fans. You know, they don't like change as much as they want. Oh, we want something new and original. They don't really. They want everything to kind of carry on as it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Which isn't the instinct of the writer, really.
No, and when they get something new and original, they think it's awful and then hate it. So they want a new hope again. But they've already had a new hope twice. So you can't redo
twice,
it the same
time.
I know. Well, there we are.
I wrote into the Blue Box podcast making that point. Now it's roundly denounced by all of you.
Why? What did you say? Go on.
That The Force Awakens was basically just a copy of Star Wars A New Hope.
Joe, you know, I get it, but I don't think it's the same. I still don't think it's the same. I think it arouses all of the tones and the kind of, I suppose, the beats. Is that what you mean? Is that what people mean when they say it's just like A New Hope again?
It's a similar narrative.
No, I mean, it's almost literally.
You do think it's literally the same story?
No, I say almost literally.
Mm.
But, there has to come a point, doesn't it? There was a point there, wasn't there, where there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There were 7 Star Wars films out at one point, and 3 of them were based around the plot of a space station that could destroy a planet.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it's the same thing again.
It depends.
Elderly father figure to the new protagonist is killed by the baddie as well.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, but for me, it's kind of that's the nature of the beast. That's kind of the point. And I'm not, you know, I think that's a personal thing. If you don't want the story to do that, then you're not going to enjoy it in the same way, because there is a familiarity to Star Wars that there are mirrors between the episodes. There are, if you look at the shape of the stories of the trilogy, or at least of the original trilogy, is that there is a shape there. There is every film starts has so many, you know, has the 3 acts. It has 3 locations. And it kind of does the same thing on purpose.
That's a storytelling format, isn't it? Rather than...
Yeah, I think...
repeating the same plot.
Yes. But you think Force Awakens is retelling the same plot?
Yeah, essentially. Yes, okay. A New Hope doesn't have 2 old favourites coming back. But yeah, and I mean, what is Kylo Thingamy? But just...
He's a wannabe Darth Vader. That's...
I just think it's just too... I just think it didn't... I enjoyed it, but it's not something I'd want to watch again.
I'll be honest with you, I love it more than A New Hope. I enjoy it more.
Hold on, I've just got to revive Doc. I'll just get the smelling salts out.
Because it's an upgrade. It's an upgrade. It's an upgrade of the original, and the characters are better. It's like A New Hope for now, and that's why And I kind of feel that it was successful in what it did, in as much as it had to start things up again. So it was always going to mirror what had gone before, but equally the characters themselves, you know, people like Finn, the fact that he was a stormtrooper and is coming back from something else.
But that's the other thing. Oh, sorry, Sam. That was very rude of me. Carry on. What you're saying was interesting.
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, again, the whole writery thing is that you can discuss these things without wanting to kill each other. And I find I do find it all interesting. And I can kind of see it from all angles. The only thing that does upset me is when people say, oh, you shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have done this. And it's like, well, it wasn't your choice. And if you don't like it, then don't watch it.
Mark, just pass me your Federation rifle, would you please?
And I don't mean that in a dismissive way. I just think that these things are big enough that you can pick and choose what you like.
Yeah.
I'm not a massive fan of the McCoy years. If I'm completely honest, I find them very difficult. But I'm not going to spend all my time hating on them. They do frustrate me, but I'm not going to spend all my time...
Does it infuriate me? It just makes me think, couldn't they have been...
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit more imaginative.
The thing is, though, with any long-running saga or with any long-running story, I mean, look at James Bond as well. I mean, you can pretty much individually pick an era by Bond and just say, well, that's my era. That's the only one I really like from that lot as well, you know. I know there's an awful lot... I mean, the Daniel Craig era is incredibly divisive, you know. And for me, it goes brilliant film, crap film, brilliant film, crap film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. But like Simon said, I don't hate on these things because, you know, people may get something from Quantum of Solace that I didn't. But the same with Star Wars. I mean, I really, and it isn't just I'm not just saying this, you know, to be kind of cool to say it and to join in with everyone else, but I really hate the prequels. But I was of the age that the prequels were being made for.
I quite like them.
Oh, God, yeah. No.
Yeah. I'm the same, Doc. I'm the same. But because I can kind of see what they're trying to do. And at the end of the day, you know, do I sit down on my bum and switch it on and enjoy it for that period of time? Yeah, I do. I do, because I watched The Phantom Menace for the first time in years the other day. And it was like, this is all right. This is an all right way of filling 2 hours. It's not challenging me.
I suppose being a tax collector. what do they call the thing that that comes up at the beginning of each Star Wars film?
Yeah, the crawl.
The crawl. People say crawl starts talking about taxation of outlying systems. How can anyone be interested in that? I was just trying to stop myself from when I saw that. And I think it's possibly delivery as opposed to story making that weakens it. I mean, if they had found someone who could do a better performance than Hayden Christensen,
yeah,
and if they'd given him some, you know, bothered to give him some motivation for actually turning to the dark side, rather than just being in a bad mood one morning, I mean, brilliant. No, I love them.
You know, if there's one thing that bugs me about The Phantom Menace, it's Ewan McGregor's hair. Changing.
You were saying Hayden then, were you?
Yeah, Ewan McGregor's hair just changing all the time because of the reshoots. So one minute it's spiky, gelled up, and the next minute it looks like a thick ginger wig. It's just really odd, and it's very distracting. One thing I was going to say is that there are stories going around the web now that they're supposedly rebooting Star Wars to get rid of the three new films.
Oh, that's silly.
To change history so that they don't... I mean, as if they're going to do that. I mean, honestly.
No.
As if.
No.
I really like Rogue One.
I like Solo as well.
This has been a tangent worthy of Diddly Dum the early years.
Yes.
But before we move on, I must defend myself. And this will be my last word on the subject. Simon, I will forgive, because he's been brought up by JR. He doesn't know any better. But Hayden, you ought to know better. I won't be accused of hating on something, even on Doctor Who, which matters to me far more than Star Wars. We don't, on Diddly Dum, call for anyone to be sacked or replaced. And we don't attack them personally. We very specifically eschew that on this podcast, and in return we retain the right to say whatever we like, and if anyone doesn't like it, tough. I'm not a Star Wars fan. I love the films, and I watched the originals multiple times at the cinema, but I've never read the comics, I never collected the toys, or worn the cosplay. I've never been anywhere near a Star Wars forum, so for me it's entirely a matter of observation, rather than outrage. And I've mentioned this twice in 5 years, so that's hardly spending all my time hating on it. I do wonder how much of the argument justifying the plot of Force Awakens as being necessary, or even desirable, is just retrospective. If you want your new film to achieve the Star Wars vibe, then you duplicate the themes of the original if you want to, but not its plot points, one by one. The orphan is raised on a desert planet. And what crash lands on that desert planet? A droid holding vital information and being desperately sought by the goodies and the baddies. Oh, who are the baddies? Well, the First Order's the Empire. Same ships, same identical ships, identical uniforms, identical role, same planet-destroying station, which ends with lots of little ships attacking the planet destroyer and managing to do so thanks to a technical weak spot. If you'd been told back in whenever, pre-2015, that a seventh Star Wars film was on the drawing board, would you have thought, oh, I hope it's a more diverse replica of A New Hope, because otherwise it won't work for a new generation? I doubt it. Anyway, I think we're going too far away from comics.
Yes, possibly.
I must say, I've come up with a new format for the Diddly Dum podcast. In summertime, we're going to invite on guests to talk about subjects about which I know nothing, because I've just spent the last 20 minutes with my mic muted and all the fans on, and it's been delicious. I loved the bit where Simon said, I was talking about Marvel or DC, and oh, the chronology's all to pot. So I thought, oh, they've got their own unit dating controversy in America. Is there a difference between DC and Marvel in the sense, say, a fundamental one? Is it more just that one's got the rights to one set of characters and one's got the rights to another set of characters? I mean, is the style noticeably different?
DC if you go into the history of it, started off, I suppose, with newspaper strips, didn't it? Am I right, Hayden? I'm trying to think so, really. Yeah. It started off with certain syndicated strips that got bought up by a company, and then they kind of lumped them all together, as it were.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So they were quite disparate. They weren't all coming from the same creative team, whereas Marvel, aside from, well, I say that aside from Captain America, Captain America did come from Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
But in the mainstay, that big glut, that incredible, it's almost like the Beatles. When the Beatles had those huge creative periods where it was just like album, you know, it's no wonder they burnt themselves out like they did. It was much the same, and it was all about 1963 onwards, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was going to say, like Doctor Who, 1963 onwards, that.
Ironically, this, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, you're right, also about the same time as the Beatles.
Very, very odd. I mean, so you had this team of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko coming up with the Hulk, coming up with the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Daredevil, Thor, Iron Man. All the ones you're essentially seeing in the Avengers movies were all created within the space of about 12 to 18 months, and then the X-Men not far after that. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Yeah, just incredible, really. But because they came from the same creative team, they had almost like a... That's where Stan Lee did bring in... Because, I mean, there's ongoing stories about who did what, and, I mean, I think the bottom line is that Jack Kirby probably did do most of the work. But Stan Lee did have this backbone of saying that he wanted his heroes rooted in reality so they had real-world problems, which would make them relatable. And that's the big difference between Marvel and DC, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, DC makes up its cities as well, while Marvel grounds it in real places that we know and we're familiar with. So, like, Batman lives in Gotham City, or, you know, Superman lives in Metropolis. DC make up their own places, whilst Marvel have... I think most of them live in New York, don't they? From what I gather, yeah.
Well, that's always been the principle I've tried to pursue with the Diddly Dum podcast, that our problems must be rooted in reality. Mark,
mm-hmm.
Can you just pop your head out of the window and check how Quadrophenia in Mummerset is going on?
Count the mopeds.
Don't go anywhere in that alley. Something I was going to ask last time, when we were talking about comics... You know how, I don't know if it still is, but no, it isn't because it's Panini now, isn't it? But how Doctor Who Weekly started as a Marvel publication. Yeah. Those of you who obviously, well, the three of you not like me, had you not known that it was a Marvel publication, is there anything about the style of it, about, I don't know, the sort of artwork, the sort of the layout of it that is Marvel-esque, should we say? You might think to yourself, if you didn't know, oh, this looks like a Marvel publication.
Not really, I don't think, because it's Marvel UK, which is very different.
Oh, I see. Right.
I mean, I was buying the Marvel UK comics at the same time, so they were full of the reprints of the American strips. But also, there were some gorgeous... Des Skin managed to pull together quite an amazing pool of artists, British artists, which I imagine he kind of gleaned from 2000 AD and pulled them across, who were producing British Marvel strips. So there are, I can't even remember the artist, but there are some British black and white Hulk strips. Mm.
Yeah.
There was a character called Night Raven, whether you've ever heard of them, which was drawn by David Lloyd. There were backup strips in Hulk comic, if I remember rightly. So I was aware of Doctor Who Weekly purely because I saw it advertised in the other comics that I was buying. So that connection was always there. I know what you're saying, though. It does have an instantly very British feel to it, Doctor Who Weekly.
Mm.
You know, I can imagine if that were to happen today, the first fear of all the fans would be, oh, my God, it'll be all Americanized. And it wasn't. It really wasn't. It didn't... You know, I mean, Starburst was Marvel originally, wasn't it? Starburst magazine.
Oh, right.
Yeah, around the same time. So, yeah, hence Des Skin involved with that.
Mind you, Starburst had some very dodgy colonists working for them, didn't they?
They did.
The Marvel reprints of the Doctor Who magazine strips that I mentioned last week, which were produced for the American market and colourised, those magazines seemed a lot more American. They were made for Americans. because you'd end up with, like, they tried their hand at book reviewing, and I think it was Doctor Who and the Zabi they reviewed, and the guy said, this is one of the worst books I've ever read. The character throughout is referred to as Doctor Who, and that's not his name. Hmm. And they got very upset about it.
Is it true that in trying to Americanize the Sixth Doctor strips, they rewrote Perry as someone with a really unconvincing British accent? Now, in the early days of the Diddly Dum podcast, the motif of the Horn of Rassilon was invented as a sort of 60-second...
Oh. Whoops.
60 seconds to talk about this. Having just talked about this particular one for 51 minutes, I think we ought to move on. We might have to lose the whole Star Wars. I don't know, actually. Or we might end up with...
Yeah.
Part 3.
Comics Part 3, which will infuriate Hayden, who for months now has been saying to me, when are we going to do this bloody Peter Davison retrospective that people have been voting for? Simon.
Yes.
Talk to us about the Sixth Doctor comic strips in Doctor Who magazine.
Okay. I was actually getting Doctor Who magazine regularly. As I said in the last episode, I got given a load of the Peter Davison era monthlies. Right the way through, actually. I think I've got all the Peter Davisons. So I got used to that. But then there was just this sudden change where they changed the artist as well as the Doctor all at the same time. So it all kicked in straight away with the Shapeshifter. I think that was the first one, wasn't it? So they introduced Frobisher straight away alongside having this artist who had a kind of warmth to it. It was almost crafted, the artwork, in comparison to what had gone before, and certainly different from what you would, funnily enough, like you say, where you were saying about, you know, was Doctor Who Weekly, did it feel like a Marvel comic?
Mm.
And certainly that was not a Marvel-style artist in any way.
Is this John Ridgway?
John Ridgway. You know, yeah. And you immediately, it brings to mind a lot of the strips you used to get in Lookin, or, you know, artists like, is it Arthur Rance?
Yes.
Ransom, certainly the surname. I can't remember. He used to write...
Yes, it is Arthur.
Button Man in 2000 AD as well. But then there's another artist in there who drew Tarzan, like the Tarzan strips in the newspapers. And they had these almost... They almost look like woodcut because the line work is so intricate and so textured that it felt like a different feel. And I'm going to jump to it now. I'm going to put forward that I prefer the Sixth Doctor's era in comic strip form than I do on TV or any other form, because it works. That costume, the character, his look and everything like that, and the oddity of it suddenly just works because it's all slightly strange, and they bring in Frobisher, you know, he's walking around with a penguin, but it works.
His costume does work a lot better in black and white, doesn't it?
there is. That's a very good point. It may be as simple as that. But it was all sort of quite surreal and quite odd and quite Hitchhikers from the off with a Shapeshifter.
Mm.
That it took Doctor Who into a different level. And it's just suddenly, even now, it feels like Colin Baker's Doctor to work on stories with that grandeur where he's dealing with almost like godlike beings and being taken into these odd dreamlike situations like in Once Upon a Time Lord. It makes perfect sense because everything goes up to a level. And I don't know if it was a conscious thing for Steve Parkhouse to create Frobisher to kind of balance out all of that. I don't know. It comes across as quite a clever decision for me. But I just have a real... Certainly for the first length, when John Ridgway was drawing without being inked by someone else, it was a real golden era of the Doctor Who strip for me. It really was gorgeous. And when the strip Once Upon a Time Lord came along, and you've got those pages that appear like Rupert comics, and you're like, you know, a little light bulb goes off in your head, and you think, of course this is why this artwork feels so warm and friendly, because I grew up reading Rupert, you know, and it's got that same golden age of comic artwork thing going on that works beautifully with Doctor Who.
Yeah,
and I don't think it's ever matched that again. It is an era in its own right, and I really, you know, I just adore it, which is why I picked it when you asked me.
Rupert, look at the bell. Everyone sing his name. Rupert, Rupert.
I thought myself, because I'd never read it before, and before we started researching for these two podcasts, and I thought, oh dear, when the Torchwood series, Children of Earth, was on, and they were talking about, they've called Peter Capaldi's character Frobisher or something.
Mm.
So people started talking about penguins, and I was thinking, what are they talking about? Well, he used to go around with a penguin. Clearly the comic strip had reached the point where they were just being silly. But I love him. he's possibly my favourite character in the whole... apart from the older Fudge, who I must say I model myself on as a manager at work, I adore him. I think he works so... And you'd think, wouldn't you? Even worse than K-9. Well, there's so little he can do. He can't pick things up with flippers. And he can't run, but it's just... Oh, it's absolutely glorious.
Mm-hmm.
I love the things like... looking at Voyager, things like those... what did you call them last time? Splash frames, where you've got that giant waterfall.
Mm. Oh,
God. One of the men's with that enormous octopus coming out of... what do they call it? That unpronounceable word in
Cthulhu.
Lovecraft.
Cthulhu.
Unpronounceable by people from the north, that is, let's say. Oh, I love that sort of thing. Was there a big spiral staircase in that one or something as well?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, no, I loved it. And I thought I wouldn't. I thought, oh, how can I get past the fact I don't particularly like the 6th and 7th Doctor Zeros on TV? And I did.
I think that this goes back to what Simon was saying about there being a warmth, is that Frobisher is a very warm and endearing character. And I think having someone there with a more abrasive doctor, even though even Colin's doctor seems to be a lot calmer and a little less assertive in these comic strips, it really balances him out, I think, in a way that they never really did with Perry on TV. Now, Voyager is wonderful.
Talking of which, Perry!
Mm.
What they turned her into? It's not anything like Nicola Brent.
I was almost disappointed when they brought her into it. You know, it was kind of, this is working as it is. Don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, I don't really get it.
It's interesting that they sort of start doing with her what Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat did with the companions on TV, which is sort of let her have her own little life, and then the Doctor occasionally comes and picks her up and says, "Come on, we're going on an adventure," which happens later on. Sorry, I keep interrupting Mark. Go on, Mark.
Just trying to think, when was the... In the comic strip, is this the first time the Doctor has a TV companion that he's actually on television with? Am I being stupid and missing something blindingly obvious?
In DWM,
Beyond
K-9. No. Yeah, no, he didn't have another... Perry was the first TV companion.
Right, yeah. I thought it was. Yeah, so I agree. It sort of jarred with me slightly when I was reading it. So I agree with Simon that it seems a shame almost to bring her in, but... because Frobisher is such an excellent companion. And the other thing I like about it is he's a shape changer, but they pretty much just say, oh, look, he's just happy as a penguin, so he's not going to keep changing shape all the time.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It could become very boring and far too easy, couldn't it, to get out of things.
Yeah.
But instead, I think they only use his shape changing ability to escape from something a couple of times, don't they, where he just... I mean, I think one of those doesn't work. He grows into a giant man and somebody shoves a spear in his knee and he's like, oh.
Yeah. That's in the story with the Draconians, isn't it, that one?
Yeah.
No, he's great. It's sad when he decides to stay on that planet at the end. Story is that. Is that World Shapers? I'm getting ahead of this.
He stays, Frobisher leaves in a cold day in hell.
Oh, right, okay.
It's problematic anyway because it's DWM attempting to do the continuity of intertwine the continuity of the TV series, because by that point it's Sylvester McCoy. So Sylvester McCoy has, the Seventh Doctor has an adventure with Frobisher, and Frobisher's a bit down and depressed in it, saying, oh, well, Perry's left, and since Perry's gone, nothing really seems that much fun anymore. And you think, well, if you're trying to intertwine this with the TV series now, then you've missed out Mel. Where's Mel? It starts to get a little confusing. It's around that point, I think, the comics lose a little bit of focus for a while, because with trying to bring it in line more with the TV series, you lose a bit of that originality And this goes through into the Eighth Doctor era as well, where there's an awful lot of callbacks to the folklore of the TV series.
Yeah.
Which starts, I don't know, it starts being less original.
Yeah, I've still got something to say about Sixth Doctor.
Go for it.
So I just wanted to say also, having just mentioned it, World Shapers, sorry, is a Sixth Doctor story, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, World Shapers is one of the Sixth Doctor stories that I've always remembered ever since I first clapped eyes on it. Firstly, because it's by one of my favourite comic writers, Grant Morrison. Very much ended up becoming some sort of kind of rival to Alan Moore in more ways than one, I think.
Mm.
I think they both fancy themselves to be wizards, for starters. So, Grant Morrison, and who does the artwork for this one?
Well, Shapes, I think that was one of Alan Moore's favourite comic strips, I seem to remember him telling us.
It's got a lovely... It's great because they go back in time and... Well, sorry, they don't go back in time. Obviously, they travel through time. Just ignore that whole sentence. The Doctor goes back and meets up with Jamie. The whole plot is designed just to tie up a little loose end from the invasion, isn't it? Where the cyber controller says, I've met you and the Doctor and Jamie on Planet 14.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the whole story is to sort of tie that up. And it does some very weird stuff with continuity regarding the Cybermen.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing with the Vord.
Yeah, so the Vord... spoiler, yeah.
And Jamie's fate as well, of course.
Oh, Jamie's fate, yes. Yeah, very, well, it's really sad, actually, that he's been basically living in a shack where everyone refers to him as Mad Jamie ever since the Doctor dropped him off and he's tried to tell people about his adventure. Yeah. They've all just gone, oh, there he is. There goes Mad Jamie, the nutter who lives in that shack.
Yeah.
And this is sort of, what, set 40 or 50 years after that? After the Doctor's dropped him off? So he spent a few decades, like, living in isolation, being mocked, which is a really harsh fate, isn't it? And then, of course, he's delighted to meet up with the Doctor and go off on one last adventure, which does indeed prove to be Jamie's last adventure, which is very upsetting, because it's so nice to see him again.
It's very sad, isn't it? Because it says that he manages to keep his memories, but it's his memories that drive him insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, properly tragic, because he kind of gets what he wants, which is he maintains his memories, but they end up making him a social outcast the rest of his life. And then he dies.
But I was going to say, by that point, I'm assuming, I'm trying to read between the lines, I'm assuming that John Ridgway was struggling to keep up with the artwork, because at some point he starts being inked by Tim Perkins. I mean, this is a very artsy thing to say, but you do notice straight away, and whether Tim Perkins had to do some rush jobs to get things to catch up when he first starts, because the quality, no offence to Mr. Perkins, but the quality does diminish. It's not quite the same, is it? It's like straightforward line work, and you lose that lovely texture that you get from John Ridgway doing his own inking.
Yeah, the detail really suffers, doesn't it? Because you look at that splash page that Doc mentioned earlier of the waterfall and the tortoise and the elephants and the people sort of holding the end of the world up. It's beautifully detailed. And like you say, it's said as well, the texture of it is just amazing. And you do definitely notice towards the end of John Ridgway's run that I think possibly before he's being inked by someone else, that it does start looking a little bit more slapdash, it's probably time pressures, isn't it?
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, when you look at his work, I can only imagine his work does take some time, and maybe some enthusiasm goes as well. I don't know. You know, it becomes more like a treadmill.
That's, yeah, of course, Voyager and Shapeshifters were early on, weren't they? Well, they were his first ones, so they're sort of done with a great deal of love and attention, and this is something new and something I put my heart and soul into. And then sort of 2 years later, he's probably, oh, I'll draw that bloody jacket again.
Mm. Yeah. Artists are only human, after all. So.
Mm. Indeed. Well, I think the artwork itself is... Reading them back, I didn't notice it too much, the changeover. It's very noticeable going from... Like, when Dave Gibbons left, I think after that, you lose a little element of that detail. But then you get it back again with John Ridgway and with Voyager. You know, it's stupendous. I'd be quite inclined to see the colour copy of it, actually, to see how it looks. It was reprinted in America?
Yeah.
In full splash colour, so, yeah, it'd be good to see it like that. But
Well, I'm not sure it is good to see like that. Because I did have all of them as on my computer, but unfortunately I've lost them due to that. Do you remember a couple of months ago I did that massive? My computer needed to be reset.
I lost those files,
unfortunately.
I'm assuming those John Ridgways are drawn in order to be viewed in black and white, you know, that if it affects your decisions with inking and things like that. So you're essentially just tinting them, aren't you?
Mm. Yeah. All those original strips weren't they?
Yeah.
Apart from that two pages that Dave Gibbons did, which we mentioned last time from Tide to Time. But yeah, it's all meant to be black and white. So it's, and honestly, some of the colouring is just it's so unsympathetic to the stories that it's just appalling.
It'd be nice to see them done again, actually. Get someone like Adrian Salmon on them. Would be something else. But I'll come back to Mr. Salmon later.
Well, I think that's all. I just wanted to mention World Shapers. Are we going to do another round of the horn? Or
go for it. Around the horn.
Are you there, Doc?
Sorry about that. You can talk to me now. My purple light is on. What's that I hear? Is it the horn of Rassilon? Mark, have you got something for us to take us briefly away from Doctor Who?
Oh, yes. My comics childhood, perhaps.
Fire away.
Okay. I've got a brother who's 4 years older than me, so I've been reading his comics since as long as I can remember. I used to get Beano delivered. I used to read Buster, Whizzer and Chips.
Oh, me too. Oh.
Were you a whiz kid or a chipite?
I don't remember that well now. I know I was a big Ken Reed fan.
Oh, right. Because it was, you could read the comic one way or the other, couldn't you? Couldn't you flip it over and it was half and half? You could literally...
Could you?
You could pull out the centre pages and create your Chips comic.
That was Whizzer and Chips.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
And depending who you supported, you were either a whiz kid or a chipite. It was like a war between the whiz kids and the chipites. I was always a chipite because it always felt like they were the underdog, so...
It was a bit like the Jocks and the Geordies.
Yeah.
God, I forgot about that comic strip. Something just popped into my head. I can't remember which one that was in now.
Which one?
The Jocks and the Geordies.
Is it Dandy or Beezer? I'm trying to remember.
I was going to say it was Viz.
I know.
I think it's Biffa Bacon.
I know. That's clearly what Biffa Bacon was based on, isn't it?
Oh, it was in the Dandy. I've just looked it up.
Oh, all right. Thank you very much. Yeah, Ken Reed was my favourite artist who did Faceache.
Yeah, I remember Faceache, yeah. Yes, that was a great favourite of mine at the time.
And he did loads of just very bizarre...
It was almost like something out of Mad, wasn't it?
Yes, very stylized. He very much had his own style. You can always tell when it's Ken Reed artwork. Just the details, absolutely brilliant. Also, there was a... And Cheeky as well. I, to be honest, I was a bit of a comic. I was a bit of a comic slag. I'd read any comic, really. I was easy for them all.
You slag!
Yeah. Show me some pictures and some word bubbles, and I'd be well away. Yeah, I'm reading my brother's 2000 Ds as well. But perhaps my most exciting thing that ever happened to me regarding comics, it must have been around about December or November 1983. So I'd have been 12, and there was a comic came out called Spike. It was a DC Thompson comic. It only lasted about 15 months, and they had this letters page in there, and they also had one of their artists. If you sent in a photograph of yourself, and you could say, oh, I want to be Kenny Dalglish, and they get their cartoonist to draw, get your head, they like enlarge it on their photocopy or whatever, and the cartoonist would draw like Kenny Dalglish's body in a Liverpool strip. And they print that in the comic with some sort of amalgamation of your name. So say it was somebody called Timmy wanted to be Kenny Dalglish. He'd be called Timmy Dalglish. And it would have the kid's head on like a cartoon of Kenny Dalglish's body. Or there'd be somebody who'd be, I want to be James Bond. So it'd be like Alan Bond. And, you know, again... At my school, for some reason, E.T. had come out in 82, wasn't it, I think? And for some reason, the kids at my school decided that my neck was slightly longer than normal. So I almost instantly earned the name E.T., which was actually quite upsetting. And lesbians go, oh, E.T. I mean, there's nothing that remarkable about my neck, to be honest.
Mark, kindred spirits. In 1982, right, I had a bad accident, I ended up in a collar. So I was going around school in a collar, and I used to be called E.T. as well.
Oh.
And it's really hurtful, isn't it? It's horrible.
It was. But anyway, I wrote in to Spike Comic. I sent them a picture of myself on my old school photos. And I thought, I'm going to own this. And I wrote in and said, I would like to be E.T. And so anyway, they sent me a £5 check in the post, a Spike kit bag, and said, yes, thank you. We're going to print your thing. It'll be out on whatever day the comic came out on. And so I remember the day at lunchtime, I took one of my friends down to the local newsagents and said, come down to the local newsagents. I've got something to show you. I hadn't even seen the copy myself. Anyway, so I saw the new issue of Spike had come out. And so I went up with my mate and I grabbed this copy of Spike off the rack and said, look, check this out. And I flicked forward to the letters pages. And there it was. There was a picture of me with my head on a cartoon of E.T.'s body. And he was phoning home. And it just said Mark John above it, because they obviously can't make a funny play on E.T. So it just said Mark John. Clearly had my face. And so I remember I showed it to my friend, and my friend literally staggered backwards in shock. And I have to say, it was possibly one of the greatest feelings of my life to be in a comic. Certainly at that point, it really was. I went back to school feeling like an absolute giant of a man. And I was just like, ha, look at this. And yeah, and to be honest, being called E.T. again didn't really bother me so much after that, because I'd actually become E.T. in a comic that you could buy in the newsagents. So screw you. That's my comics tale.
Brilliant.
I knew those comics mainly through annuals. If you got one of those, a Dandy annual or a Beano annual, I was always a little bit disappointed. Yes. It was Dandy and not Beano. But if I got an annual in my Christmas stocking, it was always a really special thing. Because I'd end up rereading them, God knows how many times, to the point where I'd know pages by heart.
Yeah, I know you didn't get into 2000 AD until later, but throughout my childhood and right up until into my 20s, my mum brought me a 2000 AD and a Judge Dredd annual, if available.
Me too.
Every birthday, and right up until I was easily into my mid to late 20s, every
and
year.
And the Dalek ones when they were around in the 70s for me. Mm.
Yeah. I just thought they were really funny. Like, there would always be those illustrations on the inside covers on the Beanos. So it was usually like all the characters running along with big-headed versions of celebrities of the time. So it'd be like,
oh yes,
Bruce Forsyth running along with them, and some sports personality that no one can remember anymore, and Sally James, things like that.
Yeah, Daley Thompson or something. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I can't find my copy of you as E.T. Have you got it to hand?
Well, part of it is in my Twitter banner.
Oh, yes.
To be honest, I know this won't come as a great shock, but I wouldn't mind taking a break for a couple of minutes or so.
Okay, well, let's have an intermission, shall we? See you after the break, listeners.
Ice cream, or maybe some nuts, a cool glass of orange, why not try a hot dog? From the sales staff and in the foyer, now.
From outer space, the famous TARDIS brings Time Lord Doctor Who and the amazing Leela, ready to do battle against their mighty enemies, the fearful Cybermen, the giant robot, and one of the deadly Daleks. Whilst Leela covers him, the Doctor reaches the TARDIS in time and disappears to escape from the Dalek. Doctor Who, Leela, the fearful inhabitants of outer space, and the TARDIS, from Dennis Fisher. Fantastic.
May we remind you that for the convenience of those patrons who prefer not to smoke, seating areas on the right-hand side of this auditorium have been designated as no-smoking areas. Your cooperation is appreciated.
I've just found an old photo of you from the height of your jamminess days.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. There I am. I was in the five-ish Doctors twice, Simon.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, I was an extra. I was in the autograph queue waiting for Peter Davison. And I'm visible on screen for a brief second, and then I was waving at the camera when they were filming when he pulled up outside the hotel.
Oh, I can see. Yeah. I can see on the messages.
And all this time, Mark was just at home burying his head in a pillow, weren't you?
Well.
Yes, exactly. I didn't actually mean that. So what were we just talking about? Mark was just telling his thingy, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see any pictures of all the stuff we're talking about, including pictures of Mark as E.T. Faithless Assistance, all you need to do is go over to our show notes at our blog on diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com and you'll be able to see all the links to them. We'll also add in a plethora of links to things Simon related. Also remember to ask Simon at the end where we can find him. Although we don't need to find him because otherwise he wouldn't be here, would he? Right, so I think we've now got on to the Seventh Doctor, and I think, Hayden, you were going to try and merge him with the Eighth, am I right?
Yeah, because this is kind of where I come in with Doctor Who magazine, was issue number 242. And the interesting thing about that one was that it was the last one to have a comic strip featuring the Seventh Doctor. And the following month was going to be the first Eighth Doctor story printed in the magazine called Endgame. And I was thoroughly confused by it. And I remember thinking, looking back now, it's sort of like a fan's dream headcanon where you have the Seventh Doctor, Ace, Susan, Sarah Jane Smith and Perry in a comic strip called Ground Zero when they face off against a creation of the human mind called the Lobbery, I think it was called. And it culminates in Ace losing her life at the end of it.
Oh, God.
What number was this, Hayden?
This was number 242. So my first Doctor Who magazine comic strip was the final part of Ground Zero where I saw Ace dying. And this was the one which obviously ended the continuity of Ace in the comic strip, ended the Seventh Doctor's era. But not only that, but it really brought about the end of that cross-continuity I was talking about during Colin Baker's era that started to seep through. Because if you look back at the Seventh Doctor's time in the magazine, you've got stuff like A Cold Day in Hell, which is where Frobisher leaves at the very start, and the Doctor picks up this being called Ola, who can sort of She sort of like burn people up with energy.
Oh, the heat vampire.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. And then she sticks around and then for another, just one more strip after A Cold Day in Hell called Redemption, where she turns out she's a fugitive and she goes on trial, and that leaves the Doctor to travel by himself for a little while. But then after that, you get to a story called Planet of the Dead, where the Doctor's aligned again with a cascade of characters from friends from the past. Frobisher comes back, Jamie's in it, Katarina and Sarah Kingdom and Adric are all here too. And it's kind of from here, really, in that there's little hints of it before this where the continuity really sort of... It becomes very headcanon-y. It almost becomes a little fan fiction-y to me, where if I wanted to throw in the Fourth Doctor for shits and giggles, I'd throw the Fourth Doctor in for shits and giggles, if you know what I mean. You know, it's... And this sort of happens the whole way through, and after the show goes off air, at the end of 1989, there's a very brief period where DWM has the only ongoing adventures of the Doctor in any format before the new adventures came out, with, I think it's Time We're in Genesis, wasn't it? It was the first one. So there was a little bit of time there, but it seems to be very stuck on dipping in and out of its mythology the whole time. And what I like about the early comic strips, and actually from what I've seen from the newer ones as well, is that they seem far more interested in telling their own story and creating new ideas. And you may occasionally get an old adversary coming back, but this was incredibly frequent during the Seventh Doctor's era. And it all culminates with Ground Zero, where, like I said, you know, you've got Sarah's back, Susan's back, Perry's back, Ace dies, and it really sort of sets up the Doctor's isolation going into the TV movie. But the TV movie had aired, 2 or 3 months, I think, before Ground Zero came out. So it's more of a... It's an interesting one, but the there's a very definite cutting off point with the death of Ace, where Doctor Who adventures in Doctor Who magazine go off on their own tangent and they tell their own stories again, which is where with the Eighth Doctor, I think, is where you get some of the most original storytelling since the Steve Parkhouse days in DWM. And again, it is mixed in with a sort of greatest hits package. Every now and then, it's not as often, but every now and then you will get, you know, callbacks to a previous era, or you'll get a Dalek story, or you'll get, you know, but more importantly, it's not dipping back into its own mythology within the comic strips. So you do get characters like Shade coming back, and you get Absalom Dark is in one of them, or is that a Seventh Doctor one? You'll have to forgive me here, listeners, sorry. I'm doing most of this from memory.
It's a Seventh Doctor one, isn't it? He comes back in Nemesis of the Dalek.
Ah, right.
And Emperor of the Daleks.
That's it. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so... Okay, so they did call upon the mythology a little bit in the Seventh Doctor's era, but I feel as though it was a very easy time to do that in the comic strips, because you've got nothing going on. You know, the TV's obviously the main medium for Doctor Who. You've got nothing new coming out there, and bringing a fan's favourite back was a good thing. And one of the fan favourites... and subsequently became a favourite of mine, was a Cyberman called Croton.
Oh.
And he joined the Doctor and Izzy during the Eighth Doctor's run. And his sort of arc, his arc culminated in a 10-part story, which ran, bloody hell, pretty much throughout the whole of 2000, sorry, was a 10-part story called The Glorious Dead, which also saw the return of the Master as well. And, I absolutely loved Croton. I had a little Daypole Cyberman figure, and I used to actually play Croton. Like, Croton would be playing with, like, my Captain Scarlet and Star Wars figures, you know, and sort of taking part in the adventures, because I loved him so much from the comic strip. I was obsessed with Cybermen anyway, but the concept of a good Cyberman was one I found really interesting, and I was always quite shocked, because I always pictured Croton was being a younger man in human form, and he wasn't. It was revealed in The Glorious Dead that, you know, he'd been married, he'd had kids, and he was, you know, a much maturer man, you know, sort of greying around the temples. And I was quite sad when he left at the end of the story, and I think that actually culminated in, you know, the end of me buying DWM regularly after that for a good number of years. But The Glorious Dead's a great story. I mean, as a 10-parter, it's incredibly ambitious. And it does quite a lot too. I mean, it brings the Master back. It brings back a character called Sato Kasura, who ends up has been manipulated by the Master. And also quite a cool set of baddies called the Glory. And it was also one of the last DWM comic strips that was made in black and white as well. Which is quite interesting to think that they're still doing black and white comic strips into the 21st century. But yeah, after this, it really started to change again. So this kind of feels to me a little bit like it's kind of the end of that era of classic comic strips, really. Do any of you remember The Glorious Dead at all?
I'm just looking at it now. I McCoy years came in and I kind of moved away from Doctor Who magazine.
Mm.
It's an ongoing joke in the Strangers in Space podcast about my relationship with the Doctor Who logo in the 1990s.
Oh, right, yeah.
I absolutely detest it. And JR keeps saying,
"Knew that was coming."
It's based on the 2000 AD logo. I'm thinking, well, it looks nothing like the 2000 AD logo.
No,
it was one of those. I was that age is where I would be embarrassed to buy it. That sounds bad, doesn't it? But it did. It kind of.
No, looked... I know. I totally on board. It wasn't a good era for me either. Really, it was definitely sort of late 80s. Was me finishing school and going to college and leaving uncool stuff behind. At least.
Until 4 years ago.
No, just, you think you're too cool for this sort of stuff, so you think, I'm not. Like certain bands, like Madness. I used to like Madness when I was a kid, and then I got a bit older, and I was like, they're just a pop band, aren't they? I'm into more serious rock music now.
Have you gone back to them now?
I have no problem with them whatsoever, but I haven't revisited them that much. But there is a lot of stuff that I kind of... Yeah, there's a lot of stuff which when you're growing up, you just think, I'm just too cool for this now. I'm different. I'm a different person.
Mark used to take his music very seriously. If you've seen that photo of him with as a sort of half goth, half rocker.
Well, from Midwich, my rock band.
Yes. Your rock band that you look hard as nails, but it's best not to ask what their names are. Oh, was it Florian and...
No, Adrian, Melvin and Perrin.
It's like bad news, isn't it? Oh, that's brilliant.
Hold on. I think I have got a photo of that, so we're quite nearby.
Do any of them listen to this?
No.
Good, well, I can leave that bit in then.
No, I don't think anyone who knows them will listen to this either, I'm hoping.
Well, I'm just looking at the final part of Ground Zero. I've not seen this film. It's gorgeous. A lovely picture of the Doctor carrying Ace. Yes. Doctor's finally fixed his tie. There's a great picture of a sort of devastated console room from above.
Yeah.
And I love the one of the TARDIS materialising in the same space as a giant spider.
Yes.
Oh, shrit. That's something I've been enjoying, reading these. Artist's choices for, what do they call them? Those bubbles where it's kapow or aye. I made a note of that one where the TARDIS lands in a bathtub and Shade is pulling it out.
Oh, in the tides of time.
Isn't
it? Yeah. Sound of a TARDIS dropping into a giant... I must have lost it somewhere.
Well, also, I mean, one thing the Doctor Who comics from the Doctor Who magazine has given us is the sound effect warp, isn't it?
Oh, warp. Yes. Yeah.
Which is just... I don't know. Thinking about it, I'm not sure if it's entirely right, but at the same time, because it's been that way since I've been reading those comics since I was a kid, it's just become proper...
Marcus E.T. had a brilliant photo.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to say as well that the Ground Zero also, of course, had the Threshold in it, who were the main bad of that, which did run into the Paul McGann era in the magazine.
What was that, sorry?
The Threshold, which was sort of like they were this sort of... They looked like people, but they had, like, chroma dots in them.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
It's just sort of like a word like the Silence or something, a race from group of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very much... I think this was around the era when Martin Geraghty and Scott Gray really cemented themselves as writer and artist for DWM, and it was a really good, solid, strong period.
I was going to say, when you were saying that there was this great era, and when it stopped, you stopped buying it, who would have been the writers and the artists at that time?
Oh, it was still Gray and Geraghty, but the reason mm-hmm. why I stopped it was almost for the same reason that Mark stopped it, was that... It was that period where you sort of enter your teens and you start conforming to what everyone else is doing, and anything uncool sort of gets packed away in a box under the bed for a few years until you get out of that stupid period in your life, and then you find yourself again.
I remember when I hit puberty, I thought, I'm too cool for Billy Bunter now, so...
Yeah, I didn't actually pick up... I mean, I've missed stories like The Flood, the last Eighth Doctor story in DWM, and I missed all of the Ninth Doctor era. And I only really remember... The only one I really remember for the Tenth Doctor was The Crimson Hand, because that was around the point where I started buying the magazine again, and that pretty much went all the way through probably the tail end of Tennant's era through to Matt Smith. And then again, I just sort of stopped, and I've never really gone... Apart from like the 400th issue and the 30th anniversary issue, I don't think I've bought any DWM in about 6 or 7 years now. So I think for me, I mean, because the 10th and the 11th Doctors are quite vague, and I think at that point I was reading it for other things. You know, I was reading it for The Watcher, and I was reading it for, the DWM archive, and I was reading it for the interviews and the previews of what was coming up in the next series. Yeah, and then the comic strip just sort of slipped away for me, really. I think there's just something quite magical about seeing it in black and white as well. And then when it moved into colour, maybe age lost me a little. But I think The Glorious Dead is pretty much the last one that really stuck with me, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. But I don't know whether you boys used to do this. You used to decimate the magazine and cut pages out and then put them in your own, like, in clear see-through binding pouches and put them in like a ring binder. Did anyone used to do that?
A few of my Star Wars comics, I taped them together when it was one story.
That's it, yeah.
And then instantly regretted it afterwards.
Yeah.
No, I've got the it's a Doctor Who monthly, I think. It's got a I've told you about this before. It's got a pin-up of the Tomb of the Cybermen on the back page, and I cut that page off and put it over my light switch and cut through the chest unit of the Cyberman so that the light switch was sticking through, and I blue tacked the chest unit back on. So I had to push the Cyberman's chest unit to turn my lights on and off.
Oh, the things we do.
Yeah, oh, what a wildlife.
It's funny, isn't it? Because you had that period with Doctor Who where you had, you know, with the new series, where you had the new series on, and you had Sarah Jane on, and you had Torchwood, and you had cartoons, and you had all that, and there was that saturation point. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what happened with the comics with me, was it felt like it was all quite generic, and that's probably an insult and not a fair comment on the work that went into them. So it'd be nice to revisit them, actually, and look on them with different eyes, because it felt, for that period we're talking about, and certainly from the Colin Baker era, it felt like it was bringing something that you weren't getting on screen. It was bringing a depth in that wasn't on screen, and now that depth is there, I think. You know, you watch stories now and you think, oh, this could so easily be a comic strip.
Yeah.
And I don't think you ever got that with the inverted commas classic, or 20th century Who, did you? There was a limit to the, you know, obviously with the, and again, this brings us nicely back round to the Iron Legion, in as much as we looked at that and said, oh my God, this is Doctor Who with a budget, you know. It's that same thing, and the series has almost eclipsed the strip in a way. And I'd like, if I was to read a Doctor Who comic, I would like it to go places that the series can't.
Yeah.
And I don't think, when I've looked, it has. If I was to pick out one of the modern strips that I did pick up on and thought was amazing, I can't remember which episode, which one it was or issue, but it was one where it was Donna saying goodbye. Did anyone see that one where the Doctor finds a holographic message from Donna?
Yes, I remember that.
No.
Yes.
That's the sort of thing you want to read. I'll have to look it up. But
I did get brought a trade collection of the recent-ish Doctor Who story that had, I don't think it had the 12th Doctor in it. I think it's just goes up to Matt Smith. But it's the one where it starts off with the first Doctor and a couple of the companions disappear. And then it switches to the second Doctor and he loses a couple of companions. And it's all done by different artists. And it goes all the way through, and you find out that obviously somebody's kidnapping the Doctor's companions, and it's been done to lure the Doctor into a trap. And probably you might have heard who the protagonist is, it turns out. I'm not sure if I should say, because if people haven't read it, then it's a massive spoiler, but it's also quite bizarre.
Well, I was thinking of doing a podcast looking back on the Second World War, but I didn't want to say who won in case people hadn't followed it yet. And
oh, right. You don't hold with this worrying about spoiler stuff, do you? okay, well, it's...
Oh, right.
So, yeah, it's him, and he's so angry with the Doctor that he ends up becoming some sort of powerful time-manipulating person. He goes back and starts kidnapping the Doctor's companions. I think there might be someone else. There might even be a bigger bad than him who's influencing him.
That sounds dangerously close to Ace qualifying for the Time Lord Academy, doesn't it?
But it's quite an interesting story because it's done with different artists and it's lots of different doctors, so it's quite nice.
Did any of you see Wurzel Gummidge over New Year?
Oh, God, no. I keep forgetting to watch it.
Do you remember the bad scarecrows?
Yes.
Oh, are you suggesting that picture of me with Midwich?
Actually, oh. I think we can say without reservation that Mark is by far the most handsome of those four.
That's you on the left, is it?
Yes, it is me on the left.
Yeah, there we go. You're the most normal looking.
Oh, okay. thank you, I think.
Mark, tell us, what happened?
What happened, what?
That beautiful angelic-looking child on E.T.'s body.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a sentence that's ever been said before, is it?
No, I don't think so.
That comic strip with Donna in is called The Time of My Life. I've just found it.
That's the one.
And it's in Doctor Who Monthly number 399. And it's a one-off strip. And it's like a little goodbye from Donna, which is lovely. The sort of thing you'd imagine Stephen Moffat writing. written by Jonathan Morris. There we go.
Oh, well, the guy from Animal Magic.
And artist Rob Davis, who I believe is friends with Lee Rawlings, as far as I know.
Oh, I knew there had to be some, I knew there had to be someone.
Yeah.
Right. Are we to drawing to a close of our what we can say about the Doctor's strip, or have we got anything else to say?
Just quickly, I just want to say about the what I said about the Threshold earlier. They were the main villains in a number of stories overlapping the 7th and 8th Doctor eras, but they also were there at an introduction, a sort of a tryout for a new 9th Doctor who was in the guise of Nicholas Briggs.
Oh, yes!
In a story called Wormwood, this new character is introduced as the 9th Doctor, but it quickly becomes, again, spoiler alert, quickly becomes clear that it's actually Shade masquerading as the Doctor. But this was actually Doctor Who magazine trying out a new incarnation to see if the readers would accept a new incarnation.
Yes.
To do their own exclusive Doctor in the magazine. And, well, I don't think there was a phone-in vote this time to kill off the Nick Briggs Doctor, as there were Jason Todd, the Batman. But obviously it was a plan that never came to fruition, and Shade was called back.
He appeared earlier, didn't he, in Party Animals, which was a seventh Doctor strip, as a waiter.
So this was a long game played by DWM then?
Yes, maybe, yes, very long game.
Ooh, hang on, what's that? Is that the Horn of Rassilon?
I think it blows for thee, Doc.
I think I better have a little moment to myself, do you? This actually, a lot of this ties in with what Mark was saying, although it doesn't build up to me appearing on E.T.'s body at all. And none of my friends ever staggered backwards in surprise at anything I've ever done. Childhood comics for me bring back memories of mergers, mainly. Mergers and a lack of political correctness. If the time team have got hold of half the comic strips in some of my old comics, they'd have been swooning all around. They'd have been staggering backwards. The earliest comic I can remember, a lot of my early comics as a child, they weren't that dissimilar in the end to the Deanie and the Bander, the Deanie and the Bander, to the Beanie and the Dander.
Tigo and Turlan.
The Beano and the Tandy. That essentially they were, it was just a different characters, which essentially all doing the same thing, and they'd all end up with either a slap-up meal or getting slippered by their dad at the end of the story. The earliest comic I can remember reading is Core! !! Founded in 1970, I think, which I think provided Pat Mills and John Wagner with their first regular writing work. Core had things like Gus the Gorilla. The strip I remember, that I most remember, that is Ivor Lott and Tony Broke.
Yes.
I think you can already tell the level of wit that was here. A classic tale of rich against poor. And then in 1974, Core merged with Buster, which Mark has spoken about. And before I started researching this for this podcast, I was thinking, oh, I must have gradually, just tired of one comic and gone on to another. Why did I decide to ditch Core and go on to Buster? It must just have been that that's what, because we were, my mum and dad ran a newsagents at the time. It must just have been that they realised that that's what it had become. And that's what they probably put on my bottom of my bed on a Saturday morning or something. Talking of Court and Buster, at the last Capital 4 event, Mark and I interviewed John Freeman, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes, John Freeman also wrote Planet of the Dead for DWM, by the way. Sorry. Well, he was editor, wasn't he, for a while?
Yeah, editor.
Editor. And he wrote Planet of the Dead and probably a couple of others as well, I think. As editors did, although they used to put the name Max Stockbridge on them, didn't they, for a few years.
John Freeman, past designer and editor of DWM, I think, and he runs the Belting Comics website /blog, downthetubes.net.
Yep.
And I think at that time, when they were at Capital Ford, they'd issued that Core Buster special, hadn't they?
Yes, I've still got your copy, actually, because I've got two copies, because I brought your copy down and left mine up in my room. I brought your copy down to give to you. But we met John Freeman. And I said, oh, I want to get my copy signed. And you said, oh, just get my copy signed. Unfortunately, I forgot. I brought both copies home. So I still have your copy.
Jammy thing. And then at some stage I must have moved on from Buster to Shiver and Shake, which ran from about 73 to 74. And that was another... I mean, this was borrowed from the Wizard and Chips idea, whereby it was a magazine in two halves. And, oh, were you a wizard or were you a chip? Were you a fan of Shiver the Ghost or Shake the Elephant, I think it was called? So I imagine it's quite similar to the sort of DC Marvel split, isn't it, really, in a way? Two comics, Shiver and Shake, Wizard and Chips, two comics in one.
Oh, we forgot Nutty as well, because Nutty merged with something as well, didn't it, at one point? Do you remember Nutty?
Oh, I never saw Nutty.
Because Nutty's where Banana Man started out.
Oh, it wasn't, was it? Wow.
Wow, I'd forgotten about Nutty.
That was quite late, though, wasn't it? That was early, I don't know, 82, 83, I'm guessing? I don't know.
Possibly.
82, 83.
You say that's late, Simon?
Well, it is, really.
I was thinking all of us in that year. Shiver and Shake then eventually merged with Whoopee shortly after that launched in 1974. I don't think what they do is they didn't change the name. They would launch a competitor and decide that there wasn't enough of an audience for both, so they would merge the old one with it. And then briefly, it would be Whoopee with Shiver and Shake in small letters at the bottom, and then gradually it would all disappear. Mm. Whoopi had characters such as Grimly Fiendish.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
The rottenest crook in the world. Also, the inspiration for that song by The Damned, Grimly Fiendish.
Great band. Great band.
Awesome song. Really good.
Mm. Yeah. Sweeney Toddler, the two-year-old toddler from hell. Tough Nut and Softy Centre. That's what I mean by the non-politically correct stuff. A tough but not very bright bully, and he's, how they describe it in Wikipedia, he's rather effeminate victim. Although Softy could at times be as unpleasant a character as Tough Nut, showing a malicious, vindictive streak. 1974, Whoopi ran for ages, didn't it? Until about mid-80s, I think. And it eventually merged with Wizard and Chips in about 1985, I think. Mustafa Million.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
The boy... this is very subtle in Wikipedia. Presumably of Middle Eastern descent, it says. Who was sent to be educated in the UK after he discovered a fortune in oil. The Bumpkin Billionaires.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Which I think is effectively the Beverly Hillbillies in a comic strip form. And two comics in one, double the fun. It doesn't even rhyme, does it?
It used to happen with the Marvel UK comics as well. They would merge, as you know, when the sales would dip, they would merge it with another comic. Pretty sure quite a few. It was always Spider-Man came out on top. The Spider-Man comic would always absorb everything else.
Sid Snake, wear him out, Wilf.
Yeah.
An unfortunate fellow with a wearing affliction. Almost everything he came into contact with would get worn out almost in seconds. And then around the start of 1977, whichever comic it was reading, whether it was Wizard and Chips or Shiver and Shake, whatever, in the middle had a four-page pull-out advert for a new comic, which was coming in the following week, called 2000 AD. I think it was a vague sort of pinkish-bluish colour. It's advert, that's how well I can remember it. And let's have a look. If I got the... And computer, could you bring it up on the screen, please? Don't make any plans for the future until you've read 2000 AD. Out Monday the 21st of February 1977. Free fantastic space spinner in your first issue. I think it went over my neighbour's fence the first time I used that.
I think send it into orbit with a flip of your wrist. Done that a few times.
Flash into the future with the most amazing stories ever read on planet Earth. Dan Dare. Invasion. Flesh. Harlem Heroes. Mm. So, I must have been exactly the right age because it excited me beyond belief. And I think I almost that same day, I went off to our local little village post office, come news agents, and ordered it. Very, very happy days. I mean, that was really my main grown-up reading comics experience.
Did you have the free stickers in week two?
Oh, yes.
As well?
Stuck them on my...
Did you become a Biotronic man wearing those fantastic full-colour stickers?
I did, and I never changed.
No. They were quite funny, actually, because famously those wouldn't actually wash off with hot, soapy water like they're supposed to. Many kids... One kid put the cybernetic eye on his forehead and ended up having to go to school with it because his mother couldn't scrub it off.
So I won't go into too great detail about the details of 2008. If you want to go to our podcast 24, when I Al and the Rev made the mistake of saying to me at the beginning, oh, Doc, how did your trip to the BFI to see the release of the 2008 Future Shock film go? And about an hour and a half later, I shut up.
Yeah, I liked that episode.
But, again, the same thing happened. They released Star-Lord, which is the comic my best friend Howard used to get. And we used to swap them. And because Star-Lord was a sort of glossy, full-colour one, I was thinking he must have been right slightly cooler and more sophisticated than I was. But that eventually got merged with 2000 AD. Then they had Tornado. Or did it come in this order?
Yes.
Tornado did the same. And they would effectively harvest the best stories from Star-Lord, like Roadbusters, which became the ABC Warriors, and Strontium Dog, things like that. Tornado. I can't remember what they kept that was any good at that.
Black Hawk?
Oh, yes. Was he the Roman Centurion?
Yeah, he was a black slave, yes, wasn't he, who became a gladiator or something. And then, yeah, he started off in Roman times, and then when he came to 2000 AD, he was suddenly travelling through alien worlds and things, wasn't he?
Well, we've all done that, haven't we? Tony, whereas the editor of the conceit for 2000 AD that the editor was an alien called Tharg, and the conceit for Star-Lord that he was another alien called Star-Lord, the conceit for Tornado was that the editor was a being called Big E.
Yes, that's mentioned.
Who apparently they asked for someone to volunteer to dress in a Big E outfit, and Dave Gibbons agreed to. So for several issues of Tornado, Dave Gibbons was appearing in what shall we say, underpants on the outside of his trousers sort of outfits, and then that's merged with 2008 as well. So they all gradually disappeared. And that was how I ended up. I must have been reading 2000 AD till about maybe 1990 when I actually moved down to London. I think it possibly coincided with my mum saying it to me at one point, if you want to keep this 2000 AD, can you start paying for it yourself rather than putting it on our newspaper bill? And I think that coincided with me suddenly thinking, I'm not that interested in it, I won't keep doing it. No, but that was a glorious period. Some of the fantastic stuff, particularly in Judge Dredd. The Robot Revolution, Call Me Kenneth and the Heavy Metal Kids, Smash Crash Bash Mash, Come and Get It Human Trash, which I did once consider as a replacement of as our podcast introduction for Happy Day Faithlessness. Come and Get It Human Trash, but I thought it might be a bit too impolite. Cursed Earth, The Day the Lord Died, oh, lots of glorious things. Robo Hunter, Verdus. Oh, delightful stuff. And that's effectively when I stopped reading comics of any description, really. Occasionally, I'll buy it's almost when they put together omnibuses of these stories and release them as, shall we say, almost like a graphic novel. I'll buy those for sentimentality's sake. And you'll know, Faith and Sisters, because I never stop banging on about it, that we recently treated ourselves to Volume 1 of the Trigon Empire strips. Oh. And I think I've mentioned in that past episode of the podcast back in 2014 this story about how gradually all these great artists got poached by comic books in the States because essentially that no one in Britain would pay them any decent money or give them any rights to their own work. And that was it, really, was what I wanted to say. Then I became far too old and cool.
And then you met us.
I know, exactly.
Would it be right if we, before we sign off, if we just discuss backup strips very quickly? Just mention
Well, you might have given me some warning, Mark.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, of course. Far away.
I have to say, one of my favourites, I think I got the collected edition that came out in the early 80s of the Absalom Dart strip drawn by Steve Dillon before it went off to do its Star Tiger things. Yeah, that was... I loved that. That was absolutely fabulous. Obviously, Steve Dillon went on to draw Judge Dredd and Rogue Trooper as well for 2000 AD. That's definitely one of my favourite. I think some of my favourite stories are in those backup strips. We've already mentioned Croton, who has two of the most tragic endings to his stories, doesn't he? His first story, he basically saves a bunch of humans from the Cybermen, then shoots off into space where his battery runs out, and he ends up sat there floating with a dead battery for years. And then he gets picked up by this weird holiday cruising spaceship, and he realises that they're caught in a time loop, so he sets them free from the time loop and they all die, which leaves him sat alone on this great big freighter floating through space again by himself. And it's just, get much luck, does he? But it's he is a wonderful invention, Croton. That's Steve Moore, isn't it, who wrote most of those early strips, with a few by Alan Moore occasionally. I can't remember what we said last time around about these. Did we mention on the podcast last time about the Zygon that I liked, that Zygon artwork?
That splash pick, yes,
right,
we did.
Okay. I also really like Business as Usual as well, the Auton one that's drawn by David Lloyd.
Oh, that rings
before
a bell.
Maybe we mentioned that as well.
It's interesting, actually, is looking back through some of those early backup strips in Doctor Who, it's weird that Alan Moore was kind of tucked in the back of the magazine to do the writing because Pat Mills and John Wagner were doing the main ones. But I was looking through some of the artists. Paul Neary does a load of work there because, of course, he ended up inking all the Alan Davis stuff in the Excalibur comics we mentioned last episode.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, wasn't there another link between Alan Moore and...
He created, in that story, Dark Moon Rising or whatever it was, he created a set of aliens who worked together. They were like sort of heroes for hire type things. Mm. And they were led by a kind of like a tiger human called, can't remember his name, I have to think it up. I just remember there's a really good character called Zeitgeist who walks around in like an all-in-one black bodysuit, and he can go through walls a bit like Kitty Pryde.
Mm.
But they appear in...
Oh, they're the Special Executive, aren't they?
Special Executive, that's it. They appear in the Time Lord story way back, like being involved with Rassilon and what have you. And then the next time you see them, they turn up to kidnap Captain Britain because they've been hired by Saturnine or whatever she's called from a different...
Oh,
version
right, yes.
of Earth,
yeah,
and they're the same characters, you know. It's brilliant.
That's very cheeky, isn't it? But I guess Alan Moore created them, so he's like, I'll do what the hell I like with them.
Yeah,
isn't there quite a gap between them turning up in Doctor Who? And then
it's early days of the weekly, I think. So yeah, it's sort of 78, and then they appear in, well, the first appearance was in Daredevil's comic, which was like a monthly thing where they revive Captain Britain and they would reprint the classic Daredevil strips, you know, the Frank Miller Daredevil.
Yeah.
And stuff like that in black and white in this monthly magazine, which was really great. Loved that magazine. Yeah, because number one of Daredevil's had a Paul Neary cover. That's, I remember that now. Paul Neary drawing Captain Britain. Oh, War Dog. War Dog was the leader of the...
War Dog, yes, he's the one.
And he loses his arm in the Doctor Who strip. Then when he comes back in Captain Britain, he's got a gold robotic arm.
Right.
Oh, here we go. The Special Executive first appeared in Doctor Who Monthly 51, which was April 1981, and then they reappeared in 1983 in the Daredevils.
Oh.
And then became a feature of Marvel UK's Captain Britain, particularly in the Jasper's Warp storyline.
Ah, right, yes. That's brilliant. That Captain Britain is absolutely excellent. It does lead into Excalibur, doesn't it? Which is one of your
favourites.
Yeah, also, isn't there, because there's a woman in the special executive, isn't there, who's got very tall hair.
Yeah, she looks like the girl out of Sugar Babes.
Yeah, Heidi Klum.
Yeah.
And not Heidi Klum, that's a model, isn't it? It's Heidi, yeah. Sorry. Heidi from the Sugar Babes. Yes, she does. And, I'm sure she appears in a frame of another Doctor Who strip, like just an outline of her.
Well, as I read, I keep, because of course there was a crossover with Death's Head as well, wasn't there? The Doctor and Death's Head. And
oh, God, I forgot about Death's Head.
They created Death's Head and he was massive and they needed to get his size down to make him fit in with other characters. So they said, how can we do that? Because I think this was in one of the Strip for Actions documentaries and they said, oh, we know what we'll do. We'll stick him in the Doctor's TARDIS and the Doctor's TARDIS will make him smaller. So that's what they did.
Oh, Marvel UK. Wonderful time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real shame that, I mean, because obviously it led into Knights of Pendragon and Alastair Stewart was in that as well, wasn't he?
Oh, was he? Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so. Yeah, he's one of the main characters.
And Deskin went on to produce Warlord as well. Was it Warlord, which had V for Vendetta in it and...
Marvel Man,
yes. So, which obviously used a lot of the same artists and writers who'd been writing for DWM as well, hadn't they?
Yeah. Oh, Fascination was the name of the girl.
Ah, yes, it was. Keep feeling fascination. Or don't, if it's a girl.
Right, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Just how lovely it's been for us to read these again and discover stories that are long gone, but we're able to have a look over, thanks to these compendiums.
I would say one of the things that's missing from Marvel Unlimited is all the Doctor Who stories, because I imagine because the license has shifted, they can't put them on there anymore. I don't know. Who knows? Which is a real shame.
Who knows?
Yeah, there's also, I believe, Jim from the Crinoid podcast was saying that the backup strips are one of his favourite things from the days of DWM. And I quite agree with him, but then he said he's always hoped that they'll come out as a collected volume. But I think the rights issues with that must be so difficult, because you've got the creators of the individual monsters that are used for each different story. Plus, they're obviously like partly under BBC copyright as well. And plus, you've got things like Alan Moore, who famously fell out with Marvel. So he probably won't ever let them reprint any of his stuff that's tied in with Marvel. Well, and because Marvel are involved as well. Yeah, it must be a massive headache. So it's a shame. But yeah, it's going back through these has been some of the best homework I've ever had to do for a podcast, I
think. Yeah.
Well, there's lots of stuff we could have added had we had an unlimited time. Was it back in our podcast 92, wasn't it? We were talking about how we got on to George Orwell's essay on Boys Weeklies at the time. Which I think reminded me of all the sort of... there's a passage in Who on Earth is Tom Baker, the great man's autobiography, at the start of chapter 4, where he talks about all the comics he used to read as a boy, which were all the sort of stuff that my dad would have read, things like The Adventure and The Wizard, The Hotspur and The Champion. We won't go into that. We could have talked longer about the Dalek Chronicles, but...
Oh, yes. Absolute classic.
TV 21 and TV comic, and then now it's all spreading out into the IDW and it's and really
Star Trek crossovers.
What's IDW?
There's a publishers. They've got the rights to put out comics in America.
Oh right.
So alongside the Doctor Who magazine comic strip, and I don't know, when did Doctor Who Adventures finish? I didn't even notice it go. If I'll be honest, I don't mean that in a bad way, but there was an awful lot of being made. There was an awful lot of David Tennant comics being made at any one point. And the only times I've dipped into the IDW is on the free comic book day, just to see what's going on. But
we might have a look at the Dalek Chronicles, one of these podcasts. After all, the casing for the Golden Emperor is actually in display case 427D in the exhibition hall when I presented it back in... Podcast 26, so he must have said something about the artwork then.
And didn't somebody win the Golden Dalek Emperor cocktail cabinet from Brucey's? Play your cards right. Yes.
Happy days. Right. Simon, where can people find you usually?
I'm on Twitter, just at Simon Brett, or one word. And I'm on Facebook. I think it's facebook.com/SimonBrettArt, if I remember rightly. Hang on, I'll look it up.
Have you got a website?
I have got a website that desperately needs updating. I mean, I've got simonbrett.co.uk, but that shows some of my old artwork and a few attempts at carrying on with a blog, which usually run at about 6 months apart every time I enter something. So I've really got to nail that one.
I won some of Simon's artwork once.
Did you? Oh, yeah. Did you? Hang on.
Yeah, in a competition. Was it the Ark in Space or something? Who ran that guy gave some sort of prints and bits, signed bits of your stuff, like a Zabi postcard.
Oh, nice. Lovely.
It was a Zabi postcard, wasn't it? And some other nice bits as well, yeah. Yeah, oh. I entered the competition. I won. I was incredibly pleased. Oh. And yeah. Lovely pieces in there. I'm delighted. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that.
We shall, of course, scatter these links throughout our show notes over at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
Oh, have you mentioned Strangers in Space?
Yes, of course.
Oh, yes, and of course. Simon is a regular for as much time as he can get a word in edgeways on the Strangers in Space podcast. Which grew out of the Blue Box podcast and then merged with it and almost swallowed it, so it disappeared.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, can I just say one thing? There is a brand new charity anthology coming out from Chinbeard Books that myself and Lee Rawlings have written a story for, and that's coming out very soon. I can't remember the charity it's being done for, but there is a new book on the way.
Well, when it arrives, we shall plug it for you. On the podcast.
I think I'm allowed to say it's called Regenerations, so that's the name you need to look out for.
Oh, hey, can you hear the sons of Scarrow to say goodbye to us? Dalek Scaros. Have you got any news for us?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump babies into the river.
Oh, nothing new then. Dalek Ray. We have anti-Dalek Force ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
And on behalf of us all, I'd like to say Splundig Ver 3, listeners. Bye-bye, everyone. Till next time.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.